Hello, my name is Nicholas Parsons, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sail, and coming up in this week's show, broadcasting legend Nicholas Parsons gives us the scoop as to why he was absent from the chair of Just a Minute for the first time in 50 years.
I couldn't speak very well, so there's no point in going on radio if you haven't got any voice.
Author and listener N.B. Dixon reviews a classic woodland tale.
It's about loyalty and friendship and sacrifice.
RNIB Library curator Lynn Livingston brings us some fabulous news about a new collection of talking books.
Hercule Poirot had been brought up to believe that all outside air was best left outside, and that night air was especially dangerous to the health.
And Sarah J. Harris gives us a final peek behind the scenes of The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder. That's all coming up in today's Read On. He's Britain's longest-serving broadcaster, an actor with 8 decades of appearances on stage, screen and radio behind him, and he's still going strong. Nicholas Parsons is one of the great straight men in British comedy. It's a role he's played brilliantly, week in, week out, for over 50 years, as chairman of the radio show Just a Minute. So, when earlier this month he was absent from the chair for the first time ever, it made national headlines. And I must admit that I too was itching with curiosity when I met the 94-year-old to discuss his latest book, Welcome to Just a Minute. It's my great pleasure to welcome Nicholas Parsons to Read On.
Right. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, Red.
As part of my homework, I was reading The Straight Man, a memoir that you recorded for RNIB in 1994, and I didn't realise that had your parents had their way, we would have lost you to mechanical engineering.
Well, they were determined that I should not become an actor. I mean, I was born at a time when you didn't do as you wanted. You did it really as what your parents suggested. But the thing is that it wasn't considered popular or fashionable then to go into show business. I mean, my father, who was a very charming and delightful general practitioner, when I said I wanted to be an actor, his reaction was very succinct. He said, well, don't be ridiculous. That's not a proper job. I said, well, what about those people who are successful in the theatre? Well, he said, there are a few eccentric people who become very successful, but, I mean, you've got to get a profession. You've got to get a proper job. And so they put me into engineering. And the war was on, so what else could you do? I mean, you couldn't go to RADA anywhere. And my mother was a bit horrified because she came from a more, even more traditional family. But she just thought that everybody in the... She loved going to theatre. Oh, she was a great theatre goer. And she thought everybody in the theatre was, you know, was either debauched or peculiar. And I said, but mother, you love going to the theatre. You admire people like Laurence Olivier and Ray Richardson and Peggy Ashcroft. She said, oh, I do. I said, do you think they're all like the people you describe? She said, no, but isn't it a pity they have to work with those sort of people? So I knew I wasn't going to get any success there. I got what was called my matric quite early. The next thing I knew, they'd fixed for me to begin an engineering apprenticeship on Clydebank. I mean, it's the most bizarre thing in retrospect. There was I coming from a secure, professional, middle-class family, speaking very much with a public school accent. And next thing I was on a train going to Glasgow, where I had to find myself some digs at the YMCA, get a boiler suit, and start work on Clydebank. I didn't understand what they were talking about to begin with. And I realised instinctively that I had to make these people my friends, my mates. And I must have done something because I was such an oddball there, so out of place with my accent and everything. But I did something, and they did become my chums. And they accepted me, even though I was eccentric, and to them eccentric, because I had this very English accent. Very out of place on Clydebank. And I survived. Probably one of the few things in my life that I'm really proud of. I survived. I did 5 years. But all the time I was getting away and trying to be an actor. I mean, I went to the BBC, and you know, And I was lucky there was a Scottish Command Troop Entertainments, it was called. And because the government were encouraging everybody to do anything to help keep morale up. And so the Scottish Command, they had a lot of people based on ACAC sites and anti-aircraft sites and things around the country. And they were forming little concert parties. They were amateur concert parties. And I used to do impersonations. I used to mimic everybody, and which irritated my parents when I was at home. And I did my audition with them. I was only 16 and a half or 17. And I was in a concert party and going round in a bus to these ACAC sites, doing stand-up comedy, jokes I pinched from radio comedians, and my impersonations. And I was getting very raw experience. And then, of course, the great discovery man of the period, Carol Levis, came to the Glasgow Empire. And I plucked up the courage, and it needed courage, because my parents were sort of saying, don't get any ideas of going to that awful profession. And I asked to do an audition, and Carol Levis saw me. And I got my very first broadcast. I can remember how much I got. It was 3 guineas. It's magic. Some of those anecdotes are in my autobiography, which I regret. Now, I called it The Straight Man, my life in comedy, because I was known then as worked with Arthur Haynes and Benny Hill. And I was a foil to those comedians. And they're known in those days as The Straight Man. And I thought, well, I've been a bit of a straight man to my family and on Clyde Bank and to well-known comedians. Maybe it was a good title for a book. But I'd rather have called it my subsequent memoirs, which I brought out, which was called My Life in Comedy, which really has been my life, making the chaps on Clyde Bank laugh, trying to make my parents laugh, which was difficult. Independent television was beginning. 1956 or 55 was the bill went through Parliament, and they read that ITV, George Black Jr., was making a programme for, and he was going to take the title of his father's famous wartime show, Strike a New Note, and discover, I knew the phrase, the unknown stars of independent television. And I was desperately keen to be one of them, but it didn't happen, even though by now I'd done quite a bit. And I remember I happened to watch the first one. We went out in January 1956, and it was really terrible, pathetic. But there was one person in it who had pretty awful material, but I thought there was something rather distinctive about him. I remember saying to my wife at the time, I said, that chap's got something. Good, terrible material, but he's got something. And his name was Arthur Haynes. The following week, I happened to see the same show again, and it was even worse. I think nowadays it would have been taken off immediately, but because they had nothing in the archives to follow with. And the following morning, my agent phoned me and said, have you seen a programme called Strike a New Note? And I said, yes, isn't it absolutely pathetic? He said, they want you to join it. And I said, when do I begin? So I came in to sort of compare the show, and at the end of 6 weeks, George Black said, I'm getting rid of everybody, keeping Arthur Haynes and you, and I think you should do sketches together. And so from that evolved the Arthur Haynes Show with Nicholas Parsons, and we did comedy sketches and things like that, and then eventually became the most successful comedy show in independent television. And when people say to me, what was the most significant period of your professional life? I say always, well, it was the Arthur Haynes Show, because that's what's established me as a name to the general public.
I know that you have both dyslexia and a stammer. Deciding to become an actor isn't the first career choice that many young men with those conditions might have chosen.
Well, the dyslexia, which we didn't know what it was when I was young, and I did very well in my exams, and I think now looking back, I use my memory. I memorise things a lot. And of course that's been a tremendously good investment in show business, where you're always having to memorise scripts and so forth, particularly in rep, learning a new part in a new play for the following week and replaying another part in a different play during the day. And so the stammer, yes, I say I haven't cured it, but I've got control of it. And I had some very good voice production lessons when I was getting going in the theatre from a wonderful woman called Iris Warham, and she helped me on my voice production. And I discovered that voice production basically is breathing, and by correct breathing, I got control of my stutter. I say I haven't cured it, but I've got control of it.
So when all those years ago Ian Messiter came up with the idea, just a minute, was it literally just something scribbled down on a piece of paper, this is the idea, and just make it up as you go along?
Of course it was, yes. It is an utterly spontaneous show. There's nothing written down. That's why it's so successful. It's one of the few which is completely, utterly spontaneous. I'm there. We're all working off the top of our heads, trying to have fun. I try to generate the fun, and they try to do the thing.
Originally, you were meant to be one of the panel of comedians, rather.
I'll tell you the story. I have done a lot of radio, and I love doing different things. And I had put together a program, a satirical one, the first time they'd had satire on radio. This was a breakthrough. Now, they'd had it on the television. That was the week that was. And I put together this idea of, we called it Listen to This Space. And I went to a chap who'd written some very funny sketches for the Arthur Haynes show called Alistair Foote. And I took the idea up to the BBC. And there was a very enterprising head of Light Entertainment then called Roy Rich. And he saw the potential. Television had their breakthrough show. Why not? And we got a very experienced producer, Bill Worsley. And he said, do you want to write it with me, Nicholas? I said, no, I'm not an experienced writer. So he brought Anthony Marriott in to write. I fronted it. It broke new ground in radio. It took off. They thought it would never get on, but they did. Roy Rich pushed for it. And it became very professionally successful. And I won the award for Radio Personality of the Year. But I was now, in a way, presenting this. I'm not doing much acting or comedy performing. And I wanted to do something different because I love spreading my talent such as it is over a broad spectrum of entertainment. And I went to my friend Ian Messiter, whom I knew quite well, lived near him. Have you any ideas? Because he'd already sold many ideas to radio. And he said, I've got a program called 1 Minute Please, which was very successful in the past. And I've adjusted it and changed it a bit. I'm going to call it Just a Minute. So I took the idea up to the BBC, and they took it on to do a pilot. And the idea was I was going to be on the panel because I wanted to do improvised comedy. Jimmy Edwards was scheduled to be the chairman. Jimmy was never free on a Sunday when they wanted to record the pilot, because in television and radio, you record a pilot show first. That is presented to the powers that be, and if they like it, they commission a series. And the producer, a very clever young man called David Hatch, who'd just come down from Cambridge, came to me and said, I don't think I'm ever going to get Jimmy free on a Sunday. Will you be chairman for the pilot? And I said, no, David, I'm not right for it. I don't want to do that job. Definitely not right for it. And he said, I'll do a deal with you. You do the chairmanship for the pilot, and if we get a series, you're back on the panel. So on that basis, I agreed. We did the pilot. It was a disaster. It really was. Absolutely disaster. Ian Messiter may be a great inventor, but he'd inhibited everybody by giving them all kinds of different rounds. It's a fiendishly difficult game to play, you know, to emphasize, but it's a spontaneous show, nothing script. And then he had a round where you couldn't use plurals, another round where you couldn't use the definitive article, and they were floundering all over the place. But David Hatch saw the potential, and he fought to get a series. I believe he even put his job on the line. And when I wrote my book about the history of Just a Minute, called Welcome to Just a Minute, I dedicated it to David Hatch. Because if it hadn't been for him, we'd have never got on. But having got a series, he then came to me and said, well, Nicholas, I managed to persuade them to give me a series, but there was only one thing in the pilot they quite liked, and that was your chairmanship. I said, yeah, but David, I was awful. He said, I know, but so was everybody else. Anyway, you don't turn a good job down in show business. So I accepted. And that was 50 years ago. And as I say in my one-man comedy show to do around the country, I must have done something right because I'm still doing the job after 50 years.
And I believe you've only missed one show, and that was quite recently.
Absolutely. I've already recorded four more shows. The strange thing is, the show, which I couldn't do because I had a very severe flu and I couldn't speak very well, so there's no point in going on radio if you haven't got any voice.
Were you flattered or surprised that you made national headlines by not being in the chair?
Absolutely amazed. Flattered and delighted, and they wrote very nice things.
Is there a dream team of Just a Minute panellists who, if you could assemble from all the people who have been panellists, that you would put together, and who would they be?
Probably there's a dream team, but I wouldn't think of doing it because it wouldn't be fair on some of the others. The point is that there are certain people who are very good at playing the game. They found that because it is so challenging. And we occasionally have guests on who are very well known and very talented. Always when they come on for the first time, they're struggling a little. I mean, Paul Merton, who does every series now, is a wonderful example. He adores the show, fortunately, because he doesn't do it to improve his bank balance, because he's very successful. But he's a lovely person, and he's very, very entertaining in the show. And there are a number of others who are also very good. We have a system now, and Paul and I have pushed this idea to the head of comedy, that if you have someone on who might be a lovely name, and but they're going to struggle for the first time, but you make sure you surround them with three people who have experience with the game. And I could reel off to you, but I wouldn't want to do it because I'd probably leave somebody up. You know, maybe a dozen people who are very skilled at it and very entertaining. And also I could reel off a few who should have been good, but just hadn't got what it was needed to be successful in it. And it's got nothing to do with their talent in the other fields in which they work. I'm just saying that playing Just a Minute, if you try and speak without hesitation, repetition, or deviation, and be amusing, and be interesting as well, it's a huge challenge.
Thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
The Straight Man, My Life in Comedy, written and narrated by Nicholas Parsons, is TB10187. And Nicholas Parsons, with just a hint of hesitation, repetition and deviation, is available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. His latest book, Welcome to Just a Minute, is out now in print at all good booksellers. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, we'll hear what teenagers with prosopagnosia and synesthesia make of Sarah J. Harris's treatment of their conditions in her new novel, The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder. And author N.B. Dixon presents us with a hidden gem from the RNIB Library. But first, whilst we're on the subject of our amazing library... As regular listeners will know, I love a good detective story. And for me, it all started with Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple. So, when I heard that HarperCollins had donated its entire back catalogue of Agatha Christie talking books to the RNIB Library, I used my little grey cells and found a body in the library who could tell me more. Lynn Livingston is the RNIB Library's Book Collection Development Officer. Lynn Livingston, welcome to Read On.
Hello, lovely to be here. Thank you.
It's really exciting news that HarperCollins has donated all these wonderful Agatha Christies.
HarperCollins has given us their entire back catalogue, which is an astonishing thing. And what it means is that we have the opportunity to make so many books available to our customers, and it isn't costing us any money at all. It's giving such a great choice to everybody. And within that back catalogue, we also have some new versions of books that we actually have in the library already. And with the Agatha Christie books, an awful lot of our versions were very, very elderly books. They were recorded a very long time ago. And this seemed like an amazing opportunity to just refresh the collection. One thing about it was that for some reason, our Miss Marple books were actually recorded by men, which seems crazy.
At all these houses, and indeed at practically every house in Chipping Cleghorn, he delivered every Friday a copy of the North Benham News and Chipping Cleghorn Gazette, known locally simply as the Gazette. Thus, on Friday mornings, after a hurried glance at the headlines in the daily paper, international situation critical, you know meets today, bloodhounds seek blonde typist's killer,
three collieries
idle,
23 dire food poisoning in a seaside hotel, etc. Most of the inhabitants of Chipping Cleghorn eagerly opened the Gazette and plunged into the local news. After a cursory glance at correspondence, in which the passionate hates and feuds of rural life found full play, 9 out of 10 subscribers then turned to the personal column. Here were grouped together, higgledy-piggledy, articles for sale or wanted, frenzied appeals for domestic help, innumerable insertions regarding dogs, announcements concerning poultry and garden equipment, and various other items of an interesting nature to those living in the small community of Chipping Cleghorn. This particular Friday, October the 29th, was no exception to the rule.
So we were able to put in the versions read by Joan Hickson, who, of course, is the iconic Miss Marple. You know, some people might like Geraldine McEwan, some people might like Julie McKenzie, but I think most people are like, oh, if you're thinking of Miss Marple, it's Joan Hickson. And now we have her reading the majority of the Marple books, which is pretty fabulous. And we also have a couple of the Poirots read by David Suchet, and we also have an awful lot of the Poirots read by Hugh Fraser, who some of you may remember as being David Suchet's Hastings, his sidekick. So he's actually reading the Poirot books, which is rather delightful. And then we also have a brand new version of Murder in the Orient Express, which we did as a simultaneous publication, which means that the day it comes out in the shops, we actually get it in the library. And that version is read by the newest Poirot, Kenneth Branagh. So we were very lucky to get that one as well.
I had a very pleasurable bit of homework where I sat down with an Agatha Christie I'd never read before, Murder in the Mews, and it was one read by the wonderful Nigel Hawthorne of Yes Minister fame, which was, it was a collection of short stories, which, as I say, I'd never come across before. So HarperCollins hasn't just gone for the big name Agatha Christie books, it's quite a collection of all her work, really. Did you say there were about 83 books?
Yes, and in fact, we do have them all. They have done the entire Christie collection, so we've got them all, which is rather fabulous.
And so what's going to happen to the old talking book versions of the Agatha Christies?
Well, we're not getting rid of them. They are archived, so we still have the files for them. So if somebody does have a particular recording, I mean, even if, you know, if it's one of the very, very old recordings, but it has a special place in their heart, if they get in touch with us and say, I really would really like to listen to this again, you know, we can do them a copy as a one-off kind of thing. They won't be going back in the library, but we still do have them. So if, you know, people can get in touch with us about that.
Well, it's good to know because in some ways they are actually historical documents, aren't they?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, we don't actually get rid of anything unless the master copy is in some way faulty. So, you know, we have books going way back.
Now, you are the book collection development officer, aren't you, for RNIB? Can you describe to the listeners exactly what that entails?
Basically, my job is kind of helping to curate the collection. So basically, we look at what is already in the collection and then seeing what needs to be added. So we have our collection comes from either customer requests, people have a burning desire to get a special book in the library, or it comes from bestsellers, from award winners, and then also from, you know, more niche places, like if there's a particular topic that we don't have anything on that we really should have, then we'll, you know, we'll try and plug that hole. The thing with customer requests, though, of course, we get far, far too many customer requests. We can't possibly fulfill them all. But what we do is we do consider every single request that comes in. to see if it is suitable for the library, and obviously it all comes down to quotas and finances and all that awful stuff, but you know, we do actually consider everything that comes in. So if anybody has any ideas, please give us a call or send us an email, and we'll quite happily consider your requests.
And every request is considered and looked at, presumably then?
Yes, yeah. And I mean, obviously, just to let people know, we can only actually produce about 10 books a month as live titles recorded in the studio. So considering I get about 125 requests, it does narrow it down somewhat. So we do have to make sure that people's expectations are, you know, realistic. But yeah, absolutely, we do request. We do look at every single request. And especially, you know, if it's a series that needs to be continued, or if it's a classic that we're missing, you know, those are definite things that we will look at.
So anything exciting coming into the library in the next couple of months that you can think of?
The new Anne Cleves is coming out, the new Kate Moss is coming out. We will be getting that as well. So there's big titles that we've got plans to get. We just don't have them yet.
And presumably, actually, things like HarperCollins donating their entire back catalogue, it's rather like having a new wing opened for you for the library. It must fulfil an awful lot of demand that you get from people like me who are saying, please, could you put in a new version of Sleeping Murder or whatever?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's just broadened our horizons so much. We used to only be able to pick a certain amount of content just because of finances, but now we're getting these three books in, and it means that we have such a wide range of books coming in, and, you know, really, really popular genres. So if you are into thrillers, instead of having a couple of thrillers maybe going in a month, there's lots and lots of them now. So there's much more selection for people to choose from. And not only do we have the back catalogue from HarperCollins, but they're giving us the simultaneous publications, which means that all these big titles, like, for instance, Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine. That was it won the Costa book this year. It's won all sorts of prizes as being the best book of the year. We actually got that as a simultaneous publication last year, which means the minute it appears on the stores and, you know, whichever shop you go to, we actually have it as a talking book in the library. And it's really, really important to us that we can get as much content in the library at the same time as people can walk into a bookstore and pick it off the shelf. So, you know, why should our customers be penalised? So, you know, in a perfect world, we would be able to do that with every book. Unfortunately, it's not a perfect world, but we're doing our best.
Well, it's wonderful to know that some of the publishers, at least, are on board, because it used to really frustrate me when all my friends were talking about a book and it wasn't in the RNIB library. And it does make you feel even more excluded from the world, but knowing that people like HarperCollins are donating the books. I know I've just read The Murder of Bea Larkin, which is another one of their books,
and actually been able to
recommend it to my sighted friends before they've got round to reading it, which is terrific.
It is, it's lovely. And, you know, we are in talks with other publishers that hopefully, fingers crossed, at some point down the line we may have some more positive news. But, you know, things have changed. A few years ago, this would have been unthinkable. So it is, the publishing community is reconsidering the way that they look at RNIB Library, because, you know, it's written in the constitution of this country that libraries should be available for everyone. And, you know, why should our customers be treated any different than their sighted friends?
Now, I was doing my research, although I must admit that I was tipped off. I understand that there are a couple of talking books in the library that have your name as the narrator.
Yes, they are. Back in the midst of time before I had my family, I was an actor. And I have recorded a couple of talking books. It is true. Yes, one was a young adult title called Ferryman, and one is an Emma Blair family story called Nellie Wildchild, which was set in Glasgow and tremendously fun to read.
You enjoyed the process of being a narrator then. I know that some of the narrators are just absolutely hooked on it. They say it's the best job they could do because they get to play the entire cast.
That's it, exactly. I mean, basically, when you read through a book, you read it through once and then for the story, and then you read it through it again for the character, and you mark up the characters and you decide what these characters sound like. So you get to, basically create maybe 50 different characters. And there's the scenes where you're actually, there might be four people talking in a scene, and each one has a slightly different register, a different vocal quality. It's fascinating. It's an exhausting process, though. I mean, your concentration level is really high to do it, but it's quite thrilling.
Lynn Livingston, thank you so much for all your hard work on our behalf to curate the wonderful RNIB library, and carry on the good work.
Thank you so much.
You do see, don't you, that she's got to be killed. The question floated out into the still night air, seemed to hang there a moment and then drift away, down into the darkness towards the Dead Sea.
Hercule Poirot paused it with his hand on the window catch, frowning. He shut it decisively, thereby excluding any injurious night air. Hercule Poirot had been brought up to believe that all outside air was best left outside, and that night air was especially dangerous to the health.
Thanks to Lynn Livingston. For more information on that fantastic new collection of Agatha Christie's, call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5, or visit the website rniblibrary.com.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away, with practical and emotional support, so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away, from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you, on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I listen to talking books a lot. I'm a member of the RNIB and the talking book service. I just think it's a fantastic service. I like biographies, autobiographies, sagas, some historical novels. And I also like some kind of factual specialist things. Sometimes I listen to things to do with art and philosophy. But it's just wonderful to be able to access such a diverse range of reading material, because I thought my reading life was over, which was my greatest passion in life.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come, author N.B. Dixon reviews a hidden gem from the RNIB library, but before that, let's move from classic crime fiction to a brand new whodunit, with the third podcast from Sarah J. Harris about her new novel, The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder.
Hi, my name is Sarah J. Harris, and this is The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder podcast, a three-part series exploring the conditions of synesthesia and face blindness, which both feature in my novel, The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder. On this third episode, I wanted to give you a taster of my book, whilst also seeing if Emmeline May and Sigourney Young from our previous two episodes can relate to any of the situations that Jasper experiences. Sigourney and Emmeline are here in the studio with me now. Sigourney, it's lovely to have you here. Please can you explain the kind of synesthesia that you have?
Sure, my synesthesia is called chromesthesia, so I think it's the same form that Jasper experiences in the book, and I experience sounds as colours, and so every piece of music, all of the everyday sounds that we experience in our lives, all of those have an associated colour for me.
A particular piece of music called Royal March of the Lion from Carnival of the Animals created thrilling colours for my character Jasper.
The windows of 20 Vincent Gardens swung open and loud music poured out like a long, windy snake trailing across the road and up to my bedroom, tap, tapping on the window, tap, tapping on all the windows in the street. I'm here, notice me. The colours arrived with a bang and drifted into each other's business, disrupting everything. Some might call them a nuisance. They certainly did that night and in the weeks and months to come. The glossy deep magenta cello, the dazzling bright electric dots of the piano, and the flute's light pink circles with flecks of crimson formally announced that someone new had arrived on the street. A person as well as a parakeet. They wanted to be seen. They loved loud, bright music as much as me. Later, much later, I discovered this glorious music was called the Carnival of the Animals.
Jasper loves the colours from this piece of music. Can you tell me the colours that you see for the cello, the flute and for the piano?
Yeah, I really loved hearing Jasper's experience of this. I think that even though we experience different colours, I really like the way that his experience is described. And so for the cello, he sees this magenta, and I think that's such a lovely warm colour. When I experience cello, I see deep purples and dark blues on the lower notes, but I think that richness and warmth is what we kind of are both hearing in that instrument. For the piano, he talks about bright electric pops of colour. And I definitely relate to that. I think piano notes, for me, are this great pop of blue that are kind of yellow on the inside. And so they're really lovely in those pops of pink flute as well. I experience yellow kind of bubbles floating flute notes. And so I think that, we have a lot in common in terms of the way the music moves through the streetscape. I think that that's a really interesting description of that projected synesthesia. My synesthesia is associated, and so all of those colours that I describe, I experience sort of in my mind's eye rather than the way Jasper does in the space around him.
Another issue my book explores is face blindness. I'm delighted to have Emmeline in the studio. Emmeline, can you tell me, how does a face blindness affect your life?
I work in a very large open plan office, which is a nightmare for people with face blindness, especially when you're quite distinctive looking. So everyone knows who you are. And I constantly have people sort of coming up to my desk and saying, oh, Emmeline, I need your help with something. Can you do this? And I'm like looking at them kind of going, yes, I'm trying to work out who they are. It's really bad if someone says, can you email that to me? Because then I'm like, do I at this point acknowledge that I have no idea who they are? Or do I just wait for them to go away and say, who was that? To the person next to me, which is what I usually do, because I just, half the time I can't be bothered to go, look, I have face blindness, I'm not being rude, can you just remind me who you are? Which is really awful if it turns out you've known them for like, sort of 8 years.
I close my eyes. I hear the muddy ochre of Dad's voice, but I can't draw together the image of his face in my mind. I couldn't pick him out of a lineup of men wearing blue jeans and blue shirts, his usual uniform. Is that what Dad's got on today? I can't remember. I haven't paid enough attention. When he speaks, the rusty chrome orange of Richard Chamberlain's voice pummels my eyeballs. But if he walked up to me in the street, I wouldn't be able to recognise him unless I'd memorised a distinctive detail. The make of his watch, a hat, socks featuring a character like Homer Simpson, or the colour of his voice. Those are the kinds of things I look for first, rather than hair colour or styles that change whenever people run their hands over their heads. I opened my eyes again. None of the usual clues helped me today. Rusty chrome orange wasn't wearing unusual clothes.
So, Emmeline, do you have any markers that you found effective in helping identify people?
Do you look at people's hair generally?
I do use people's hair because it's one of the most obvious things. And I think that's why I get so thrown when people change their hairstyle or change their haircut. Most people tend to wear their hair in a quite similar way at work. People have the sort of same sort of style they'll always do.
Can you sometimes not recognise people after they've had their hair cut or dyed their hair?
If it's exactly the same style and they're wearing the same clothes, I'll probably be okay. But if they've changed the colour and the style, probably not. I guess probably the most significant incident was when my now ex-boyfriend shaved his head. And he went into the bathroom with long, thick, huge hair, and he came out, and my whole body reacted as if a stranger had walked out of my bathroom.
It's quite scary.
It was terrifying. Intellectually, logically, I knew it was him, but every part of my emotion, my psyche, my subconscious, all of those parts of you that react to things without any kind of intervention of logic were screaming at me, there is a half-naked, bald stranger in your house. And he was really hurt by this. And for at least 8 months, I'd have said, until his hair started growing back, I walked straight past him in the street. He sent me a photograph of something he was trying on. I went, who's that a picture of? I understand why he was so hurt. I don't think he ever understood the depths of my difficulty.
The next clip from the book demonstrates another way that Jasper identifies people, this time through his synesthesia. The colours of people's voices help Jasper to identify who is speaking and how familiar they are. The colours also determine his response or feelings towards them.
Hello. Can I help you? Sky blue. A bright, cloudless sky blue, the kind you see on a perfect hot summer afternoon on a beach, a mixture of ultramarine and cerulean. Her voice was almost cobalt blue, like Mum's, but not quite. Yet it was close enough. More than I'd ever hoped, more than I thought possible. No one I'd met since Mum died had ever come as near to this as to her hue. My heart had dropped like a huge glass lift. This wasn't the first detective I'd met in the waiting room who'd listened carefully and only spoken reassuring white-grey murmurs. This was rusty chrome orange, possibly named after a mysterious actor from some American TV crime show. I took an instant dislike to him due to, one, his colour, obviously, two, he talked about dumb actors and claimed to be famous, three, he stared directly at me.
Sigourney, do you see the colours of people's voices?
Yeah, for me it's not as strong as when I listen to music, but for each person's voice, when they speak and when there's longer notes particularly, I can really identify the sorts of sound, the typical sounds that are within that person's voice. And when they change their tone, when they're excited and the voice goes a little higher, a little lower, then that also changes the colours that I experience.
How would you describe the colour of my voice?
When I listen to your voice, I hear a lovely, bright, smooth blue with a little bit of a lower purple in there. It's quite a deep voice when I hear it in the studio here, and is very smooth. And so it's this lovely, bright, deep blues and purple.
That's good to hear. But you like voice colours in general. They're quite pleasurable for you.
There are certain voices, I think, when you hear someone singing softly or humming to themselves, those I really notice. I have a friend who habitually whistles constantly, and he's always a haze of lovely yellows. And everyone, I think he gets asked a lot to stop whistling, and he never has to worry about that with me.
You really enjoy it.
I do. I think it's fun that there's just this nice little yellow tinkling in the background when he's around.
The next clip from my book highlights a potentially stressful scenario of being in large groups of people. In Jasper's case, it looks at how he deals with lessons at school.
I always sit at the back, fourth seat from the left, which means I've had the chance to memorise the backs of people's heads and place them in a grid. It goes something like this. Row 1, seat 3. Susie Taylor. dome-shaped skull, shoulder-length blonde hair. Row 2, seat 4. Isaiah Haddad, acne scars on the back of neck, short, black hair. Row 3, seat 1. Gemma Coben, dandruff on blazer, greasy, mousy blonde hair. Row 3, seat 2. R. Chandok, grey turban. Row 3, seat 3. Jeanne Boucher, black cornrows. It's like playing Guess Who, backwards. But unlike other games, this one I actually have a chance of winning. Unless my classmates turn around, of course, or I'm asked to recognise the students in my row further along to my right. I can't remember what they look like. I haven't been able to memorise their heads from this position.
I think if everyone had sat in the same place, like in Jasper School, that would have probably helped me, but we didn't always sit in the same tables for every class. Looking back, it probably did affect me because you kind of stop bothering getting to know people.
So it can be quite isolating.
Yeah, it can be quite isolating. University was really difficult. Living in halls I found incredibly stressful because people would be talking to you and they knew who you were and you knew what dorm you were in and what room you were in, and I would have no idea who they were, which is especially frightening when it's mixed dormitories and, you know, there's guys living in the same room and they're kind of rushing around at night naked and you don't know which one of them it is that's rushing around naked and you'd quite like to report it.
So in terms of reporting cases or if there's a crime or something, you wouldn't be able to identify the person?
No, I mean, I've had to report a few crimes in the past, and when they get to the question about can you give us a description of the suspect, I just have to say no, I can't. I can tell you what they were wearing. And I can tell you what facial expressions they were making while they were doing whatever it was they were doing to me, but I won't be able to give you a description of their face.
And do you think it made you more observant, that you were looking for those details?
I didn't realise it had made me more observant, again, until I was an adult, and I had an experience at a theatre performance where the audience were all given masks as you go in, and I realised I was walking around this building, I could see all my friends, even though they were all wearing masks, and I actually identified them more easily when their faces were taken away. Because suddenly the physical cues were all there were. And that's when I had this revelation that that's how I recognised my friends. Like, this friend of mine stands just so with her legs crossed at her ankles, and this friend hunches his shoulders forward and sways his shoulders when he's concentrating, and this friend always has their head on the side when they're listening to something really intently. And all of these little things I never realised I'd noticed. That's how I recognise people. It has nothing to do with their face.
3 days later, the colours B. Larkham and me had desperately wanted to bring to Vincent Gardens finally arrived. Happy fuchsia pink and sapphire showers with golden droplets. Cornflower and sapphire blues transformed to cobalt, into violet, and back again with flashes of gold and glowing yellow. I grabbed my binoculars and threw the window open. The sight made me scream bright blue clouds. The parakeet had returned and wasn't alone. It had brought reinforcements. A pandemonium. The birds clung to the 6 feeders in B. Larkham's front garden. I'd helped her hang them up in the oak tree after we walked home together from school. More and more parakeets arrived. I counted 20. Hundreds of tiny golden droplets exploded in a joyous fountain from the shimmering blues, pinks and purples.
Sigourney, can you tell me some of your favourite colours for everyday sounds, and if there are any sounds that you actively avoid or try to experience more of?
Yeah, well, one thing I really love is the sounds of birds, and so I really love that clip of Jasper when in one of my old houses we had lorikeets that would come and perch in the trees out the front, and so I really related to that account of the parakeets and how many colours there are and the brights, like the purples and blues and magenta and yellow, and how they go up and down and in between with such energy. I really always loved that about the lorikeets outside of the house and about any sort of bird song. I think that the sounds that are a little less pleasing are perhaps things like traffic sounds. Car horns are really textured purple, but they're a little rough and they're a little like the wrong shade of purple, you know, it's like purple that has a bit of orange in it and shouldn't.
The next clip from the book shows an example of some excuses that Jasper uses to avoid drawing attention to his face blindness.
Sorry, I forgot. It's a lie, of course, but a useful one. Like, sorry, I didn't see you. I trot it out at least once a day when I don't recognise someone I'm supposed to.
I did try to warn you,
Dad's muddy ochre voice says to Richard Chamberlain.
He doesn't recognise me if I turn up at his school unexpectedly.
He's right. I don't remember Dad's face. Richard Chamberlain's face. Anyone's face. I see them, yet I don't. Not as complete pictures.
I used to drink quite heavily in social situations, and I do think there was a connection. I think one of the reasons I liked to be drunk when I got to a social event was so that when I didn't recognise people, I go, oh, I'm just really drunk. When I gave up drinking and that excuse had been taken away from me, and it just, I started to really realise how much of a problem this was in my daily life. One time I just, sorry, I've just had too much sugar. Sorry, I've just had too much caffeine. Nowadays, I'm much more likely to go, I'm really sorry, I have a neurological condition that means I really struggle with faces, and can you just remind me of your name?
So there's a brief introduction to my novel, The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder. I really hope it's made you excited to hear more. For more information on synesthesia, go to uksynesthesia.co.uk, and for face blindness, visit faceblind.org.uk. My novel, The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder, is available in audiobook, hardback and ebook from all good retailers.
Thanks to Sarah J. Harris. The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder is available now from the RNIB Library in Braille, giant print and as TB703009. Here at Read On, we're always keen to hear from you about what you're reading and how you access your books. You can drop us a line via Twitter at @talking_books or email readonair@rnib.org.uk. NB Dixon did just that. She's not only a fan of the show, but also the author of the Outlaw's Legacy series of books, An Alternative History of Robin Hood. We'll be featuring an interview with her about her writing in a show to be broadcast next month. But meanwhile, here's a review of a book that she's reread recently.
For most of the animals of Farthing Wood, a new day was beginning. The sun had set, and the hot, moistureless air was at last cooling a little. It was dusk, and for Badger, time for activity.
Hi, this is N.B. Dixon, and here is my review of the book The Animals of Farthing Wood by Colin Dann. It's available commercially from Audible and also from RNIB Talking Books. I originally discovered this book as a child, and I was absolutely delighted to find it again as an adult. It's a fantastic animal story, so for anyone who loves books like The Wind in the Willows or Black Beauty, this is probably going to be right up your street. It's a great adventure story. It's about a group of woodland animals whose habitat is rapidly being destroyed by humans, and they are forced to seek a new home elsewhere. So when one of them returns after a long absence and explains that he spent time in a nature reserve where animals are safe and protected, they all decide that they will go there as well. And the book is about the various adventures that they have on their perilous journey and how, with every problem that they have to face, they are brought closer together as a group. It's about loyalty and friendship and sacrifice, and it's a beautifully written story, and in my view, it's the best book from the point of view of animal protagonists that's ever been written. I'll even go so far as to say I think it's better than Wind in the Willows and Black Beauty.
5 years ago, my father chaired the assembly that was called when the humans first started to build here. There were more of us then, of course. Farthing Wood was almost a forest in those days, with a large stretch of grassland all round it. And also...
Yes, yes, Fox cut in a little impatiently.
He knew Badger loved to talk about the old days. But once he started, it was sometimes very difficult to divert him.
Although The Animals of Farthing Wood is available on audio from both Audible and the RNIB Talking Books Library, the narrators aren't the same. I personally think that the narrator of the RNIB version is better. For one thing, he really does attempt to distinguish between the characters by giving them different voices. And he's also got quite an expressive voice even when he's just reading prose. The narrators for Audible, for some reason there are two of them, which would make sense maybe if the book was from a male or female perspective in each chapter, or for some other reason why multiple narrators might be used. But in this case, it's a man and a woman reading alternate chapters, and there's no rhyme or reason why that should be. While the male narrator is okay, the female narrator really didn't do anything for me. So I actually think the RNIB version is well worth checking out.
We know what it used to be like, he said, but we're concerned about what it's like at present. My father, he added, in case Badger was offended, was at that assembly, but no good came of it. What could mere animals do?
This is N.B. Dixon, and thank you again.
Thanks to N.B. Dixon, The Animals of Farthing Wood by Colin Dann, narrated by Malcolm Rithen, is TB3563. Have you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at Talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.